See it? I clicked it. I didn't hit the check, check, test. 1, 2. I don't know if that's. Mark.
On this week, no, February 5th. Oh, wait. February 5th, we didn't know. And then the 19th and 26th, the last 2 weeks, we don't know.
Okay. So he's starting February 5th.
Well, he's back on the 12th. So he's on the first week. Don't know the second week.
Staples out. Made a huge difference.
What up?
Had all the staples taken out.
Oh, wow. Good.
Yeah. So I think that happened a few days ago.
You can feel it, huh?
Greetings, everybody. Welcome to Dr. Hugh Ross's Paradox class. We're so glad to have you with us. We're going to have Dr. Ross with us again this morning, as we will all through the month of January. But come February, I think it's going to start February 5th, Robert Cavolo from Christ Church here in Sierra Madre is going to do a four-part series I think he's doing it on the theologian Abraham Kuyper. So we're going to really look forward to that. But we're going to have all Hugh most of the time for the next few months, which is wonderful. That's what this class is about. So we don't really have any announcements this morning. It's really good to see everybody. All of you that are here live, tell your friends. Paradox is back live. So let's build this audience up like we had it. We used to have it before BC, before COVID. So let's say a prayer, and we'll get to Dr. Hugh Ross. Heavenly Father, we're so grateful. We live in a country where we can still speak our mind. We thank you that we know you, that we can hear your truth of the gospel, the truth of your love for us, Lord, and the truth that even intellectually, it makes sense to follow you. We thank you for this class. I thank you for this class and all it's meant to me in the last 20 plus years, Lord. We ask your blessing on Dr. Hugh Ross this morning as he teaches us and as we go our way this afternoon. Thank you so much. Please welcome Dr. Hugh Ross.
Well, thank you, Ross, for that introduction. And, just coming from the service here at the church, I was really impressed with the message from Josh Swanson. Now, you know, we need relief from the frenetic pace of the 21st century life. And he actually mentioned how in, South Korea, you can pay $90 and they'll put you in solitary confinement for 24 or 48 hours at one of the local prisons, so you can get away from all the frenetic pace of life. And I was listening to that, it reminded me of my experience at the University of Toronto, where I did my graduate studies in astronomy and physics. And it was a fairly high-pressure situation. I mean, they really worked this hard. And one of my fellow graduate students had a nervous breakdown, and so he spent some time in the psychiatric hospital. And one of the things about the University of Toronto, they have a 16-story building where they house all the physicists and astronomers. But immediately next door to our building was a 12-story psychiatric hospital. And the joke was we needed a corridor between the two buildings. And so I wound up visiting one of my fellow graduate students in this hospital. And then right next door to him was one of my physics professors. So I went in and talked to him. He was in pajamas. And I said, "What are you doing here?" And he said, "Oh, every year I take 30 days off and I just spend my time here in this hospital. And I can forget about work. Nobody bothers me. I don't get any emails. I don't get any phone calls. My chairman in the physics department says that I'm getting psychiatric treatment and everybody is afraid to come and visit me. So I'm here all by myself. And this hospital's got this wonderful woodworking shop. I go down there and make furniture for my wife and my family. I just need that 30-day break from our frenetic life." Which basically emphasizes the principle of the Sabbath. I mean, one of the commands in the Ten Commandments is that we're to celebrate a Sabbath. Take a day out of your busy week to do what? To get away from all the stresses of our normal life, our work, and focus on the most important issues of life. And what I love about the book of Romans chapter 14, it basically says, it's one out of seven. If you choose to make it your day a Thursday, that's fine. A Saturday, that's fine. A Sunday, that's fine. In fact, I remember giving a lecture once to a bunch of Seventh-day Adventist theologians. And I said, "You celebrate the Sabbath on Saturday, but I know you theologians. You work throughout the whole Saturday. It's a work day for you. You need a Sabbath that's not Saturday, where you can get away from all the stresses of your role as a theology professor." And they said, "Yeah, you're right. Saturday's not a day off for us. We need to take that day where we basically..." And I love what Josh was saying this morning. When you do take that Sabbath, put your phone down, put your computer down, and get away from all the electronic distractions. All right. We've been doing a series on human exceptionalism. And last week I wrapped up our little series on the unique behaviors that we human beings manifest. How behaviorally we're different from any other species that's on planet Earth today or has ever existed. We spent a lot of time contrasting the behaviors and the capabilities of what humans can do compared to, say, the most advanced bipedal primates. Well, Reasons to Believe has now been in operation for 37 years. But I remember when we started Reasons to Believe, I interviewed some physical anthropologists for a show that we were sponsoring, and every one of them said that Neanderthals are anatomically identical to us human beings. There's no difference between the anatomy of a Neanderthal and the anatomy of a human being. That was 37 years ago. Today we know that's not true. There's radical differentiation between humans. In the scientific literature, they refer to us as modern humans, because in the anthropological literature, the term human encompasses any creature that's bipedal, reasonably tall, and is able to use primitive tools. And so humans would refer to Neanderthals, the Denisovans, Homo erectus, Homo heidelbergensis are all referred to as human. And so when you ever see the term Homo sapiens, it's a very broad category. A narrower category, which really isolates us human beings, is Homo sapiens sapiens. And of course, the word sapiens means thinking. The word homo means man. And so a joke in the anthropological community, what's distinct about modern humans, we think twice. Homo sapiens sapiens. And I talked last week about how we have the evidence for our unique thinking capability. What I'm going to share with you this afternoon is that we have a morphology that supports that capability for thinking, and that morphology is unique. And the term morphology in the scientific literature simply refers to the physical anatomy of the animal. So what I'm going to be focusing on today is what is there about the human anatomy, Homo sapiens sapiens anatomy, that's different from the anatomy of any other creature on Earth, either past or present. Well, here we go. Number one, we have a brain that's shaped very differently than the brain of any other primate species. What's unique about humans is instead of having, say, in fact, we'll be doing a little series where we compare the brain of Neanderthals and Denisovans with the brains of humans. But just to make a point here, when you look at the bipedal primates that preceded us, their brain structure is kind of elongated, whereas the brain structure of us humans is globular. And so rather than having a football-shaped brain, we have a basketball-shaped brain. And it's that basketball shape, that globular skull shape, that allows for room for what's called the parietal lobe. Now, there are other species that have parietal lobes, but they're small. Say, what's the parietal lobe? It's that lobe that's in the front of your brain and a little bit back of the front, but it's that part of your brain that enables you to do mathematics, philosophy, compose complex music, get into logic. It's that part that supports our religious experiences. So we have a brain structure that enables us to have a large parietal lobe. And if that lobe ever gets damaged, it hinders your capability of doing mathematics and philosophy. And again, we need to look at our brain as kind of like the physical interface. We humans are body, soul, and spirit. The spirit is not physical, but it's a spirit that basically controls the physical anatomy of the body. And so when you die, the spirit leaves the body. You continue to exist. And so, as you age, your brain becomes less and less functional. One reason why God gave us the brain sizes that he did is the older you get, the more brain cells die. And they're not replaced. But you can function quite well with only half the brain cells you had when you were 25. In fact, my younger son is a neuroclinical psychologist, and he says, Dad, my worst patients are these science professors that come in and demand that I test them for dementia. And he says, I give them this 3-hour test and tell them, you're not experiencing dementia. It's just that you're not 25 years of age anymore. Yeah, you're forgetting things. But he says, because they're seeing their cognitive capacities decline, they think they're experiencing dementia. He says, I've yet to give a test to a science professor or a scientist who actually did test to have dementia. But I'll tell you, there's a running joke at Caltech that when they give a dementia test to one of the scientists, they can't give them the standard test you get when you go see your doctor. I mean, I'm old enough now that every time I have my annual checkup, the doctor gives me a dementia test. And he asks me questions like, what are the names of your sons? What is your phone number? What is your address? What day of the week is it? What year is it? But the problem is when you talk to a typical research scientist, they don't need to know what day of the week it is. So you ask them the question, what day of the week it is? I don't know. Every day is kind of the same. And what about your home phone number? I never call myself, so I don't know what my home phone number is. So they had to come up with a special test, and the test is this. Can you write down the Navier-Stokes equations and polar coordinates and cylindrical coordinates? And I've actually got a T-shirt that has a Navier-Stokes equation on it, very tiny little letters, and it fills the entire shirt. But as I engage my scientist peers in physics, they all know the Navier-Stokes equation. And if they don't, they got dementia. So, we have this unique, and then we got hand dexterity. And I'll say a little more about the hand dexterity. But there's no other species of life that has the kind of hand dexterity that we do, which enables us to make the tools, the clothing, etc. In fact, I'll be talking about a major debate going on in the scientific community. Did the non-human bipedal primates have adequate dexterity that they could actually weave and make baskets and clothing? And the short answer is, no, this is unique to humans. We're the only ones that have the hand dexterity that makes that possible. Number three, we have a long development time. If you look at the Neanderthals, the evidence is that maybe it was 7 to 8 years between a Neanderthal being born and the time it becomes a fully functional adult. What is it for us human beings? Well, physically, it takes us about 23 years, if you're a female, to become physically fully capable, 24 years if you're a male. And if you're talking about your mental capabilities, for a woman, it reaches that peak at 24 years of age. For men, it's 25 years of age. There's a reason why when you rent a car, they will not give you a car if you're under 25 years of age. So the car rental people are well aware that we don't become fully functional adults until we're 25 years of age. But no other animal on the planet Earth today, no other animal has ever existed in the past, has had such a long development time. The other thing that is unique is that when we're born as a baby, we are completely helpless. We need to have immediate care from our parents in order to survive. And so, as whereas when you look at a chimpanzee baby, I don't know if you've ever seen any of these National Geographic movies where they show a horse being born, or a cow being born, or a goat being born. They can get up on all fours right away and start walking. They have to, because there's predators out there that are going to go after these newborn animals. And so these newborn animals have to be able to be capable right away. That's not true of us human beings. I mean, you get a brand new human being, it really is completely helpless. It can't walk, it can't talk. The eyes aren't yet fully developed. And again unique to human beings. We come out of the womb with a brain size that's only a third the size of an adult, because after all, there's a limit to how big of a baby a woman can give birth to. And so we have this long development time where we're cared for by our parents, literally for 20 years before we can be on our own. And of course, with the high technology civilization we live in, it's not like it was during the medieval periods when your children would be expected to be self-sufficient by the time they were 17 or 18. They'd be out there working and earning a living and contributing to the family. And during the revolutionary era, people would have large families. You know, the average for the American family today is slightly less than two children per woman. During the revolutionary era, it was 10. The average woman had 10 children. Why? Because that was a time when land was cheap and the wealth of the family depended on how much land they could cultivate. And children, even 8 years of age, could be put into the fields to work. And so the more children a couple had, the wealthier they were. And so they were motivated to have children, 10 children each. It explains why in revolutionary America, they had a population that was identical to the population of Britain. And so when the Revolutionary War broke out, it was between two nations, same population, same technological development, and that was a major factor in the 13 colonies being able to establish their independence. And today, of course, it's the other way around, especially if you live in a city. If you have a child living here in the United States, you're looking at $250,000 you're going to have to invest as a parent in order to get that child able to support themselves. And, you know, people know that, and they say, I don't think we're going to have too many children. And in certain parts of the world, the reproduction rate is now at a level of one child per woman, which means the population is radically declining. And why is it only one child per woman? Because of the incredible expense in places like Hong Kong and Singapore of actually raising a child is beyond what many couples are able to afford. So we have this long development time. In the 21st century, it's no longer 18 years or 20 years. It's more like 30 years. You know, I've got two sons that are in their 30s, and they're just now able to support themselves independent of my wife and I. It took more than three decades for them to reach that point where we were not having to invest a lot of time and financial resources. And I've got friends who tell me, hey, it's more like 35 years, even late 30s, before they can really launch. So we have a long development time. And here I'm just referring to the physical development time as 24 years for women, 25 years for men. Unique to humans is our high metabolic rate. I mean, if you look at the bipedal primates that preceded us, you look at the orangutans, chimpanzees, and gorillas, their body weight is the same as ours, but they don't need the calories that we need. You know, we are active all the time. And so we're not like these other animals where we spend long periods of time just sleeping or chewing our food. We're up and moving all the time. But that means we have to be eating a lot more food. And a lot of what I'll be sharing about here is how God gave us the anatomy to be able to accumulate and gather and harvest a lot of calories and a lot of nutrients. But the way our bodies are designed is that we have very high energy demands. And so, you know, humans need to be eating a lot in order to maintain their livelihood. So very high metabolic rate, and we have a long lifespan. You know, like if you've got a chimpanzee that you're caring for in the zoo and you give them really good care, they might live 40 years. It's a lot less in the wild. The average lifespan in America today is 76 years. But those of you who are in your 70s, take heart. If you're over the age of 50, your life expectancy goes up to about 85. So just taking into account, though, you know, a lot of people don't make it through childbirth or don't make it through the early infant years, is that we have a very high or lengthy lifespan, much greater than that of any of the large mammals that we see on the planet here. It is true that some whales can live to be 60 years, but we can live easily to be 80 years. And then we have extreme food chewing efficiency. You'll find an article, every week I've put out an article called Today's New Reason to Believe on our reasons.org website. A few weeks ago, I put up an article talking about the chewing efficiency of human beings. And this is crucial given our high metabolic rate. We have to find some efficient way of consuming our food. So there's a research study that was done where they were basically giving humans, you know, a gum. You chew gum. But what they did is they came up with some gums that were quite soft and then gums that were extremely stiff. But what they discovered is even when we humans are working on food that's extremely stiff and difficult to chew, our metabolic rate goes up no more than 20%. Whereas what they've noticed with chimpanzees, orangutans, and gorillas, their metabolic rate can go up over 50%. So this made them realize there's something about the human anatomy that allows us to chew our food in a very efficient way. In fact, their research study showed that in spite of humans needing so many calories and so many nutrients, way more than what the great apes need, is that we spend way less time chewing our food than they do. And so the average for a human being is 35 minutes a day. We spend 35 minutes a day chewing our food, but there's some that spend only 7 minutes a day chewing our food. I can think of a certain relative in our family who's in that category. 7 minutes is all they need. And by the way, that relative is bigger than I am. So they're needing a lot more energy than I need. And yet they're all done getting all the food that they need with just 7 minutes of chewing a day. The longest that they found with humans was 72 minutes. So between 7 minutes and 72 minutes, the average is 35 minutes. Then they did studies on chimpanzees. And for chimpanzees, it was 4.5 hours a day they spent chewing their food. Orangutans, 6.6 hours a day chewing their food. The other thing they notice about the great apes is that when they're chewing their food, they're doing nothing else. What do we humans do? We're socializing when we're chewing our food. We're thinking when we're chewing our food. I mean, again, I can think of my experience at the National Radio Astronomy Observatory. And we went to the cafeteria there, and at every place at the cafeteria, they had a plate, they had the utensils, there was napkins, but they had a notepad there and a calculator. Because they discovered if we don't provide a calculator and a notepad for all these astronomers, they're going to be scribbling all over the napkins. They're going to be scribbling on the coffee table and on the you know, the table covering. And so to prevent that from happening, they decided we're going to put a notepad and a calculator at every table there. But what was happening is that these astronomers would be solving really difficult problems while they were chewing their food. And of course, what do? We go with our friends to restaurants, we invite people in our home for a meal, and that's what's interesting is that when humans are chewing their food, it actually enhances their socialization. What you see with the great apes is that they have to stop chewing their food in order to socialize. There's so much energy they put in chewing their food, they just focus on the chewing of their food. So we humans are designed to simultaneously think, socialize, and chew. And the chewing requires very little energy. Now, of course, there's some reasons for that. We don't eat the same food that chimpanzees and the great apes eat. I mean, they're predominantly eating very woody vegetation, and they really have to put a lot of energy into chewing up the woody vegetation so they can get the calories and nutrients they need from that. And of course, all our food is raw. We humans have the capability of cooking our food. And I mentioned this last week. We see even with the earliest evidences for human existence, way deep into the last ice age, is in every case, they were preparing their food, soaking their food, grinding their food, roasting their food, boiling and cooking their food to make the food soft enough that they could chew it with very little energy. And of course, with all this food preparation, the grinding, the roasting, the soaking, the boiling, the cooking, what this does is it increases the caloric density of the food. I mean, just think of that, for example, raw spinach, and eating raw spinach as opposed to taking all the spinach and boiling it, notice that the volume gets significantly reduced. And you can consume the calories and the nutrients from boiled spinach a lot more efficiently you can if you eat it raw. And of course, this is true of the meat that we eat. It's true of everything that we eat. Our food preparation basically concentrates the calories and the nutrients. And the other thing about human beings is that when you look at our jaw structure, our teeth, the way the saliva works, the mouth structure, the facial muscles that we have, they're all optimally designed to efficiently consume easy-to-chew food. And so it's like God right away recognized he gave us the brain so we could immediately take the food we gather, prepare it, so that it could be chewed and consumed with very little energy, but also gave us the anatomy ahead of time. So we do not have a good anatomy for chewing very hard-to-eat food. And so we can't eat the same food that orangutans and gorillas eat because we don't have the anatomy to eat that coarse, raw food that's very woody in nature. But we have an amazing anatomy for being able to very efficiently consume and chew food that is easy to chew, which is why we can think and socialize at the same time that we're eating our food. In fact, our socialization is actually enhanced in eating our food, and evidently that's not going to go away in the new creation. What we see in the book of Revelation 21, when God takes us from this universe into the new creation, we're going to be feasting, we're going to have banquets, we're going to be socializing with one another while we consume food. And the interesting thing is the angels, for example, don't have to consume food. They're in a physical realm where that's not necessary, but it's an option. Evidently, that's the way it's going to be with us. We'll be the new creation. We will not need to consume food to sustain ourselves, but the consumption of food will be an option. And evidently, it's still going to be an enjoyable option. High encephalation quotient. Now, I remember 37 years ago when I was interviewing these physical anthropologists, they would say, you are aware, of course, that the Neanderthal brain is the same size as our brain. It is the same average weight. Well, that is correct. It is the same average weight. But we humans far supersede the Neanderthals in what's called the encephalization quotient. That refers to the ratio of the weight of your brain to the weight of the rest of your body. Now, just to be clear here, we're talking about what we call an optimal health body weight. I mean, here in America, we have a lot of people that are carrying extra pounds. So just think of what your optimal body weight is, and you take the weight of your brain to your optimal body weight. That's what's called the encephalization quotient. And we humans have the highest encephalation quotient of any mammal that has ever existed, either present or the past. So that's where we're ahead of the Neanderthals. And of course, we have a brain structure that's very different from the Neanderthals, a brain structure that enables these brain lobes that are capable of high intellectual function. Okay, number eight, a high leg to height ratio. And so we look at the Neanderthals, for example. You look at the chimpanzees, the gorillas, the orangutans. Notice they have short legs relative to their full body height. This is where we humans stand apart, is that if you go from the waist down to your feet, that's most of the length in your body. That's not the case with all the other primate species. In their case, most of the height is from the waist on up, and so we have a very high leg to height ratio. And this is important and enables us to walk with high efficiency and enables us to walk and think at the same time. I'll talk about that a little bit later. Is how, well, let me just jump into it now because I think it's important. And yeah, there's an article coming out on my Today's New Reason to Believe that will be going into this in a little more depth. In fact, I think it's already posted, which is studies that they've done on human subjects where they have them run a treadmill, and they have them run on a treadmill where they attach things to their thighs and to their calves. And what they do is they basically put random external pressures on the calves and the thighs so that the human subject is on the treadmill and doesn't know what kind of pressure is going to be put on the thighs. And so it's always a surprise. And you've got a guy there at the back, you know, changing the amount of pressure. And what they notice is the human subjects don't even notice. They can keep the same pace, and it doesn't matter what kind of pressure is on their legs, how much energy they have to expend. And what they also notice is no matter how they adjust the pressure on the thighs and the calves, the human subject automatically goes into a gait that's maximally energy efficient. And they do without even having to think about it. It's kind of like the way your heart works or the way the lungs work. The anatomy is all there, that all runs automatically without you thinking about it. Evidently, our walking capability is the same way. We walk, we run, we go up hills, we climb, and we can adjust our leg muscle structure in such a way that it always is maximally efficient in being able to walk the terrain that we're walking. And so if you're climbing a mountain, you have to make adjustments as the terrain changes, as the elevation rate changes, but we do it automatically without having to think about it, which explains why humans are able to engage in deep thought while they're walking or running or climbing or doing a steeplechase course, whatever. We can do that. And I think you've all had that experience where you're walking with your friends or running with your friends, and you're actually solving challenging, difficult problems while you're walking or running or climbing. And explains why humans had such a huge advantage over the Neanderthals and the Denisovans. We do know that they lived at the same time, and when humans invaded the territories of the Neanderthals and Denisovans, they quickly displaced them and drove them to extinction. Why? Because we were able, as a group, for example, to run across the hunting field and begin to go after prey, but we could be thinking and strategizing while we're doing it. And this is not something that the chimpanzees can do or the gorillas can do. They do hunt, but they're not able to work out different strategies and change their strategy. We humans can think and walk at the same time. In fact, I'd often, when I was at Caltech, we would get up from our desks and our labs, we'd go outside and we would walk, five or six of us together. Because we actually determined there were times we could think better when we're walking than we're sitting at our desks or sitting around a table. And it's amazing how many really challenging physics problems were solved just by a group of physicists or astronomers going outside and going for a 20 or 30 minute walk. This is unique to us human beings, that we're capable of being able to do this. And then we have slender skeletal frames. And so when you look at the bipedal primates that preceded us, they were shorter, their bodies were more barrel-shaped, and so we human beings, in terms of our body structure, kind of resemble a pipe or a pencil, whereas, say, with the Neanderthals, they resemble like a football. And so they had a much bigger rib cage, their legs were shorter, their arms were shorter, and we are tall and slender. And this is a factor in our ability to be able to walk with the energy efficiency. And so we can walk long distances without expending a lot of energy. And so going on a 20-mile walk is something we humans can do. And we can do without taking a rest break. That's not true of the large primates that are on the planet with us today. They're not capable of done field experiments. Yes, they're able to walk through the jungle, but they're not able to walk at the pace that we humans walk or for the length of time and be able to think. I mean, if you actually look at the history of the Roman Empire and how they ruled a good chunk of the area around the Mediterranean Sea, the reason why is they trained their soldiers to walk 50 miles a day, carrying close to 100 pounds on their back. It's amazing to think about. The average height of a Roman soldier was 5 feet, but they would walk 4.25 miles per hour, which means in a period of 10, 11 hours, they could do 50 miles. And so they had these legions that were trained to move with all of their equipment, all their engineering implements that they needed. They could go 50 miles a day. And so if something broke out in one of the provinces, they could get there within a few days with their legions. Humans have the anatomy to do that. And this is, again, something that's unique to us that we see. And because we're slender, we're able to handle heat a lot better than these other animals. The taller you are, the more slender you are, the fact that we're bipedal means that very little sunlight falls upon our body, and therefore we don't heat up like a horse does. I mean, a horse cannot handle the heat that a human can handle because of the fact so much more of their body mass is exposed to sunlight. Because we're slender and tall, very little gets exposed to sunlight. It also makes it easier for us to radiate heat away, and so we can keep cooler because we have that slender body frame. And so if you've got a barrel-shaped body, you're basically retaining a lot more heat. So a slender skeletal frame. And notice we have very little body hair. I mean, take a human being, stand them up next to a chimpanzee, and what do you immediately notice? The chimpanzee has a lot more hair than we have. And so we do have hair, but very little hair. And the fact that we have so little hair enables us to keep our bodies cool. And again, one of the things unique about human beings is that we can keep ourselves warm by wearing clothes. And we just, put on layers, take off layers. But the naked human body is ideally suited for operating under warm conditions. And so of all the primates, we're the most able to operate under hot conditions, and even for a long period of time. And it's because we have so little body hair, it's because we're slender, and it's also because we have this amazing perspiration system. So as long as we have adequate water, we can keep our bodies cool, even under the hottest conditions. But I remember visiting Sudan many years ago, and I said, what are all these water bottles doing in our room? And they said, well, we only have electricity for 1 hour a day here in Khartoum. And so when you got electricity, you fill up all the water bottles. So do we really need that many? And they said, yeah, you will really need that many, because it was 120 degrees and 100% humidity. And so we were literally drinking a quart of water several times per hour, just sweating it all out. But the fact that we could process water at that volume enabled us to keep cool in spite of those conditions without air conditioning. Okay, I got more I'm going to share about our exceptional morphology next week. We got a bunch more here we're going to talk about, but I'm past my 30 minutes, so I'm going to stop there, and we'll take questions. And as usual, I'll take questions on any subject, doesn't have to be what we talked about today, and we're going to alternate between those of you that are here in person and those of you that are participating virtually through the YouTube live streaming. I got a question here, and we're going to get you a microphone. Hang on. Can you get the microphone a little closer to you, please? Is it on?
Testing. Okay, now, when the human being is born, how long does it take the baby to develop the eye twinkling focus? How long?
Well, I had the privilege of being in the delivery room with my wife when both of our sons were born. And I was the first one to hold our firstborn son. And what I noticed was he was just staring straight into my eyes the whole time. He was making contact with me. And right away I said, I think he's going to be a philosopher. He just seems to be so intent. He wasn't crying or anything, but he was staring at everything around the room. With our second born, what I noticed was immediately he was grabbing stuff. And I says, okay, he's gonna have a personality quite different from my firstborn son. And so with my firstborn son, I remember when he was an infant, we could take him into a supermarket and he'd be perfectly behaved. He wouldn't grab anything. Our second born, he was grabbing stuff off of all the shelves. So you can tell a personality from the very minute that they come from the womb. On the other hand, what I also noticed was with both of our sons is that their eyes were not yet fully developed. They were looking around, staring at things, but they couldn't quite figure out what it was. The other thing I noticed too, even when they were a few months old, they couldn't tell the difference between a three-dimensional object and a two-dimensional full-size cutout of that object. Their eyes were not yet capable of telling the difference. But by the time they were like 6 months old, their eyes were fully developed. At that point, they could recognize small symbols. One thing a lot of parents notice is before a child is even a year old, they're able to engage with a computer. And so they're able to recognize small symbols on the computer and even begin to manipulate it to get the kind of video clips that they want to get. But the eyes are not fully developed at birth. They're developed enough that they can kind of see vaguely what's going on. But I noticed with both of our sons, is how intent they were at staring at different things, trying to figure it all out. And hey, after all, they've been stuck in the womb for 9 months, and it's dark there. And so being exposed to light for the first time. And we see this also with other mammals, like rodents. When they're born, their eyes are closed. And so they're not even able to look out. So it takes time for the eyes to develop. Is that a good answer to your question? Okay, thank you.
Hi, Hugh. We have a question from our friend Doug McComb. He says, do you think that when we get to heaven, we will all have the same IQ?
So when we get to heaven, will we all have the same IQ? Well, it depends on the IQ test you administer. So I personally believe that when we get to the new creation, we're going to be just as different from one another as we are right now. However, we're going to enter the new creation without the physical handicaps we have in this life. So people say, what will I be like in the new creation? Well, think of what you were like when you were the most fully functional in this life. And if you were born with handicaps, think of what it'd be like if you didn't have those handicaps. So that's what it's going to be like in the new creation, in my opinion. But I think we're all going to be different from one another. And we're going to revel in our differences. I believe God made every human being to be distinct from every other human being that God has ever created, past or present. And so I think one of the enjoyable things we're going to experience in the new creation is getting to know one another and appreciating our differences, being a share with one another our differences. And it's kind of like, well, let me just share with you one of the IQ tests I took. I was in high school, and there was this big exam we all got to take where thousands of students all over Vancouver took an all-day test. It was 9 hours of testing, and the idea was they were going to select the 25 top science students from Vancouver. So I got to take this test, and it was considered the Cadillac test for IQs, and it literally took 3 hours to go through the IQ test, and it was the psychologist administering it. But here's one thing. She gave me this test where it showed various comic strip segments, and it was telling a story, and I had to put it in the right chronological order. And so she gave me a couple of minutes to do it and said, you need to try again. You got it wrong. And so I tried it again, put it in a different order. And it gave me four tries and said, you're the only one of all the students I've tested who couldn't get the right answer. But then there was another part of the test where we had to basically associate things. And I remember a lot of my peers said that was the most difficult part of the test. She shared with me, I was the only one that got 100% on it. Which makes the point that when it comes to IQ, we all perform higher than our peers in some parts and lower than our peers in other parts. So in that IQ test, I got the very bottom score in one part of the test and the top score in another part of the test. I think that's the way it is in terms of our intellectual capabilities. God made us all distinct. And so, in fact, you know, there's a facility across the street from the church here for doubly handicapped or triply handicapped people. And a lot of them have mental handicaps. And some of them have been here in the class. And what you notice is, yes, they can't think like the rest of us do in some categories, but they way outperform us in others. And so I think the problem with David, McComb's question is, IQ means so much different depending who we are. It simply indicates what we're good at. We're all good at certain things, and we're all horrible at certain things, which is why we need one another. And I don't think that's going to go away in the new creation. We're still going to be able to need one another and appreciate one another.
Dr. Ross, it's very interesting when you speak about the Neanderthals, and I have some curiosities. So between humans, well, first this, what continents, are there multiple continents where you could have found the Neanderthals? And then I'd like to know from your understanding, what type of relationship did humans have with Neanderthals? What time period? Were they cooperative? Were they pets and masters, or was there war? Was there a conquest? Perhaps you could answer.
Get the microphone back on you. Good questions. And in terms of continents, the Neanderthals were in Europe and Western Asia. So there were no Neanderthals in Africa. There were none in Australia, none in North and South America. And the Neanderthals existed from about 300,000 years ago until about 45,000 years ago. But there's lots of evidence that there was a brief time period when some humans had contact with some Neanderthals. Basically around 45,000 years ago in southern Europe is where we see that evidence. And I got a book coming out on this. It'll be released sometime in 2023. But there's new evidence that shows us the population of Neanderthals and Denisovans was never very high. There weren't very many of them. Most anthropologists, in fact, the evidence tells us their total population level was never above 15,000 over their entire habitat. And it may have been less than 8,000. In fact, they believe that the maximum number of females and males that were able to reproduce, what they call the effective population, the population capable of reproduction, likely never got above 5,000, which means contact between humans and Neanderthals had to be quite minimal. There simply weren't that many Neanderthals around. Now, given their habitat area, the population density of Neanderthals was 0.002 per square mile. So the lowest population density we see of humans today is in the country of Mongolia, and there we're talking 3 humans for every square mile. So in Neanderthals, it was 0.002 maximum per square mile. And this explains why when we look at the DNA of Neanderthals, we can see that they're highly inbred. Their population level was so low that in terms of their reproduction, it was close relatives are reproducing, simply because the Neanderthals were so dispersed and their population was so low. So in answer to your question, there was contact, but there wasn't much contact. And in terms of the details of that contact, there's a lot we simply don't know. There isn't a lot of scientific evidence to indicate. We do know that when humans invaded Neanderthal territory, the Neanderthals quickly went extinct. Did they go extinct because of a war? The evidence is suggesting is that humans simply outcompeted them for their food, mainly because we humans, there were more of us, and we were able to adapt to a cold climate. We were wearing clothes. Neanderthals were not wearing clothes. So the fact they were able to wear clothes, the fact they were able to walk so much more energy efficiently means that the Neanderthals simply got outcompeted. I mean, we could get the same food that they were going after with way less energy expenditure. And that's the evidence. Neanderthals were quickly driven to extinction once they had contact with humans. So beyond that, we don't know a whole lot. We do know from what I shared with you last week is that humans were technologically capable, whereas Neanderthals simply showed the level of technology that we see in chimpanzees today. Chimpanzees use rocks. They use pieces of wood. They use spears. They shape them. Neanderthals did all that. Unique to human beings, though, we quickly had bows and arrows. And so we're able to develop complex tools and weapons that the Neanderthals did not have. That would be another factor in what have caused them to go extinct so rapidly. Follow-up.
Follow-up question I have is, when you speak of their population in those numbers, does that resemble the population of, say, mountain lions, perhaps a spread like that, or would there have been communities spread out?
You know that Neanderthals were living in communities because the evidence we see for the Neanderthals existing 60 to 45,000 years ago, almost all that evidence, in fact, I think 100% of the evidence is in caves. So evidently they were taking advantage of caves. That would actually give them some protection from the weather and the elements. And they were living in small family groups. So they weren't building towns or cities. That's unique to us humans, and then we have multi-tiered social structures. The social structures of the Neanderthals would have been families, possibly extended families, but not tribes and not towns or anything of that nature. And given the low population, we're probably just talking immediate families.
Thank you, Hugh. We have a question from Craig McMahon. He says, recently it was reported that a wormhole had been created in a quantum computer. It's not clear to me what the nature of that wormhole is. Could you characterize what was produced?
Okay, good question. I've actually had that question come up on my social media pages a lot. What's going on? Well, with quantum mechanics, you can get a lot of weird things happening that don't happen in the macro world. And so the Nobel Prize in Physics this year was awarded to individuals working on quantum entanglement, which is this idea you can have two particles widely separated from one another, but actually have some kind of causal connection to one another. That's the quantum entanglement. But it's all part and parcel of the quantum uncertainty principle. And the quantum uncertainty basically says there's weird causality going on at the quantum level, but we humans are not able to see what's going on at the quantum. It's hidden from us. So the Heisenberg uncertainty hides from human view the causality. I mean, to give you an example, this is from one of my reasons to believe colleagues, Erica Carlson. She's a physics professor at Purdue University. And what she'll do with audiences, she'll take a coin and get the coin rapidly spinning like this. So she gets it going and says, is it going to land heads or tails? We don't know. We can't determine that ahead of time. But he says, if I slam my hand on that coin, it forces the outcome. And so it'll be heads or tails. I can flip out of it. And says, so we can figure out after the effect. But while the coin is spinning, we don't know. It's hidden from our view. But when you get to the macro world, all these quantum uncertainties average out. And so whenever you look at something that's composed of even 20 quantum entities, we can determine with high precision what's going on, because you're basically averaging out all those quantum uncertainties. But this is what happened in the paper that was published by saying, we think we're seeing a quantum wormhole. And basically, the mathematics all works out. But is it possible to use a quantum wormhole to transfer information? What the researcher said, no. We just know that mathematically, this quantum structure can work. Can we take advantage of this quantum wormhole? The answer is no, we can't. But people are looking at that as trying to get some more insights in trying to build quantum computers. So, and it's similar to what we see at the macro level, is that if you've got two black holes, and a black hole is defined as a body that's so massive and so condensed that it pulls everything in towards it once you get close enough, at the core of the black hole is a singularity. It's where things become infinitely dense. And mathematically, you could take the singularity of black hole A and attach it to the singularity of black hole B, which means you could go from one space-time realm at the mouth of one black hole, travel through the wormhole, and come out into a completely different space-time realm. Many of you ever watched that TV series, Battlestar Galactica? That was all based on a wormhole. Now, the mathematics works. If we call it a physical impossibility, because of the quantum uncertainties, the probability that two black holes will perfectly touch one another and make contact with one another, that probability is zero. The probability to be stable enough for something to pass through is also zero. And so what they're finding is at the quantum level, it's the same thing. Quantum mechanics permits the structure, but can you take advantage of it to move from one quantum space-time realm to another? The answer is no. Mathematically possible, physically impossible.
So, Hugh, what was the context of the question? What happened? A computer somewhere, they think, opened a wormhole?
Well, the paper that got published, this was just a couple of weeks ago, was basically saying, we've done this quantum experiment, which really looks like we have a wormhole at the quantum level. And the paper was basically saying this is mathematically consistent. But the paper also ended saying, it would be wonderful if we could actually use this quantum black hole to get something physically significant, like moving information from one quantum space-time realm to another. But they concluded the paper saying, it'd be wonderful, but it's impossible. It's physically impossible. But the math is beautiful. So that's kind of the bottom line.
I have a question myself regarding your list, and maybe I'm jumping the gun, maybe you'll get to it next week, but it seems to me that one of the differences in human morphology between us and animals is that we can eat a much wider range of food, types of food, than almost any other animal.
Well, we can eat a much broader range of food because of the way we prepare it. The article that I wrote on the reasons.org website said, we humans were able to outcompete Neanderthals and the other bipedal primates because we greatly widened our food supply. Namely, we could harvest raw plants that were toxic and poisonous, but by treating them, we made them safe to eat. And this is true even to this day. A lot of the stuff that we would eat, if it was in its raw form, would poison you and kill you. But by boiling it and roasting it, grinding it, cooking it, you make it safe to eat. And so this is one reason why humans were able to greatly expand the range of foods that they could eat. It's because of the way they prepared the food. And so, we have a broader range than what is possible. We also have an intestinal tract that enables us to consume a wide range of food. We're omnivorous. I think I mentioned last week, our intestinal tracts are very close in design to what we see in mice and rats. And the thing about mice and rats, you know, they say of mice and rats, you can feed them anything and they'll eat it. Like us, they're capable of eating a very broad range of food. Whereas when we look at the Neanderthals, it seems like most of their calories was coming from meat, a little bit from vegetable matter, but mostly from meat. And you used to think that early humans, it was the same way. We now know that's not true. Even the earliest humans were getting most of their calories from eating plant material. What we've now discovered is even the earliest humans were involved in sophisticated food preparation, you know, harvesting these wild plants, but boiling them, roasting them, grinding them, soaking them, cooking them in such a way that it made it more efficient for us to get the nutrients and the calories, but also made it possible for us to eat a wide range of foods that otherwise be toxic and poisonous.
We don't have any more questions online. Are there any more questions from the live audience? Come on back. This will probably be the last question.
Okay.
So the scriptures say that we all sin and fall short of the glory of God. Do we have a definition of what sin is, and do animals sin?
Okay, a couple of good questions. And yeah, the biblical definition of sin is rebellion against God. What's interesting in the Bible, there's a difference between the word sin singular and sins plural. Sins plural is the outcome of our fundamental self-autonomy, our desire to run our lives independent of God. But that's what sin is. Sin is our desire for self-autonomy, saying, God's not going to tell me what to do. I'm going to do what's right in my own eyes. That is sin. The outcome of sin are sins. The words that we say, the acts that we perform, the thoughts that we think, that are counter to God's will. Do animals sin? There is no evidence of animals sinning. Now, the reason why some people think that animals sin is because of our pets that are strongly bonded to us and are so focused on desiring to please us that they take on what we interpret to be sin. So years ago, I wrote an article on this about the guilty dog syndrome. If you ever had a pet dog and a dog does something that displeases you and you rebuke that dog, what does a dog do? It takes on a guilty look. Not because it's aware of any sin. The dog just knows that's what's going to make my owner happy if I take on a guilty look. So, and they've done experiments. Do wild dogs exhibit this behavior? They don't. We only see this behavior when the animal is bonded to a human being. And the stronger the emotional bond to the human being, the more often you're going to see that guilty dog look. And they've done lab experiments, which basically says it doesn't matter what the dog did. And the only thing that matters is what the human owner thinks the dog did. And so the dog may be completely innocent of the offense, but if the human owner rebukes the dog immediately takes on the guilty look, even though the dog is not guilty. So it's all based on the fact that God designed these animals to serve and please us. So what makes a pleasure? It also explains the mean dog syndrome, because we've all met people who own dogs that are vicious. But again, I wrote another article on this saying, vicious dogs are only owned by vicious people. And so a vicious man or a woman, their dog wants to please him. And so the dog quickly figures out, okay, what brings pleasure to my owner is if I viciously attack other people and other animals. This is what makes my owner happy. And explains why you see in the book of Leviticus this statement that if the cow is in the habit of goring people or animals, the owner of the cow is to be spoken to and told, hey, you need to change the behavior of the cow. And if the cow persists in that behavior, the cow is to be killed and the owner is to be killed along with the cow. Making the point that the reason why the cow is behaving that way is because of the behavior of the human owner. And so if that happens, the owner is to be addressed, and if that behavior persists, it's not just the animal that needs to be disposed of, it's the human owner. Basically making the point, animals only behave that way if their human owner really is reprobate in their behavior. So it's the human's fault, it's not the animal's fault. And I remember when I would train people to go door to door in evangelism, I would tell them, look at the animals first. That will tell you what kind of people you're going to be dealing with when you meet them. If the animals are extremely warm and friendly and affectionate to you, that's probably how the owners are going to behave. But if the animal immediately attacks you and starts biting you, you better watch out for the owner. That principle worked out quite well. Okay, is that it for the questions?
Dr. Ross, thank you so much. Would you please close us in prayer?
Prayer, sure. Father in heaven, we thank you for this time. Thank you for the privilege of living in the 21st century when there's so much evidence for your handiwork that's being revealed to us in the book of Scripture as well as the book of nature. Help us to be better theologians. Help us to be better scientists to integrate the two books. And Father in heaven too, I pray you'd help us to manage the demands and the stresses of 21st century life, especially here in America. Help us, Lord, to honor the Sabbath, to take regular time out of our busy schedules, to retreat away from the stresses of 21st century life and focus on the most important questions of this life and the life to come. In Jesus' name, amen.